You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Hello and welcome to Truth Without Radio. Today's date is Friday the 12th of July 2019. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and we're broadcasting live at RadioAryan.com because we have with us the producer of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told, Communism by the Back Door, and the Freemasonic Victory of World War II, Mr. Dennis Wise. Dennis, how you doing? Is it hot enough for you?
Sven. I'm doing fine, thanks. Looking forward to a good show tonight.
Definitely. We've got some interesting subject matter to get into, which is really sparked off by a circular that Richard Edmonds has sent out about a scandal involving Churchill. But before we get into that, I did notice that you seem to be up to about chapter 18 on BitChute. You finally had some success with uploading to BitChute. Is that right?
Yeah, I couldn't believe it, really. I just went one after another and spent a bit of time doing it. I think 19's ready to go up anytime now.
So it just suddenly started working. Is that what happened?
That's exactly. It was like manna from heaven.
Excellent stuff. And I believe you're hard at work on episode 20. Is that almost finished now?
Yeah, I've found one or two little juicy bits as well, which is always good when I've had to wait so long. So, you know, there must have been reasons, I think.
Can you give us a hint of what the subject matter is going to be yet?
No.
None whatsoever.
Nope. Well,
go on, you've got to tell us something. You've got to tell us some of what it's going to be about, Dennis.
It's going to be about the fact that a couple of discoveries that I've found point towards this Holy Roman Empire. And the more I'm looking into it, as you know, in the past, the more, you know, it's obviously been hidden.
So it's top secret stuff that's probably not very well known that you've managed to dig out there. That's what I'm picking up from this.
Yeah, I could put it that way, yeah.
And it's going to link the Third Reich with the Holy Roman Empire some more. Because,
totally.
I mean, that's basically what the whole series has done, isn't it, is show the links between it and why it was called the Third Reich.
And the reason why, of course, that it's been hidden from especially Christians since World War II. Because obviously it was over there for 5 years and cleaned everything up so they could then carry on with the world. And Christians who were still being persecuted today have no reason why.
Well, did you know that they're actually talking about coming out with a legal footing for anti-Christian behaviour? I don't know if they're going to call it Christophobia, maybe something like that. The recommendation came out last week, and it was a report which Jeremy Hunt requisitioned. I remember a few months back, or maybe 6 months back, he spoke out and said Christians are the most persecuted people in the world. They're being massacred every day. There's massacres in Nigeria. And we need a report looking into the mistreatment of Christians. And this report has come back. And one of the things it highlights is that anti-Christian actions and behavior should be put on the same level as Islamophobia and anti-Semitism. And of course, you know, that means a legal footing with it. And he's promised to action everything that's in that report. And of course, he's a politician and he's a really slimy one at that. So I doubt whether he's going to keep to his word. But it's just interesting enough that it has actually been suggested that that should be done. And he says that that is actually what he's going to do. So I don't know whether they will. And of course, that brings up like a bit of a quandary as well, because obviously we support free speech and we don't think there should be such a thing as anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. So should we be saying we don't think there should be such a thing as Christophobia, or should we be saying, well, thank you very much. That means, you know, we can now be a protected minority. Do you know what I mean?
Well,
it's bit of a question.
I believe it when I see it, to be honest, because the whole essence of World War II was which of the two religions will rule. And obviously, we got defeated.
Yeah, and which version of Christianity as well? The Judaized version is what we've got. And no doubt, if they do come out with a Christophobia thing, it won't be to protect traditionalist Christians.
Mates, you know, they've got the No-Hide Laws set up anyway, and it, you know, they'll be his buddies.
Yeah, well, a part of that is idolaters should be executed. And, of course, according to Jews, all Christians are idolaters, proper Christians, that is. Judeo-Christians aren't. You know, they're loyal slaves to Jewry. But traditionalist Christians are classed as idolaters and capital punishment. So that's part of the Noahide laws. They're nothing to do with it. Nothing to do with Christianity anyway, the Noahide laws. That's just a made-up Jewish thing.
It's just a mess, isn't it?
Well, let's get into what Richard Edmonds has to say. Richard Edmonds is a very, very famous long-time nationalist. He was second in command in the BNP for decades, and now he's second in command, I think, in the National Front. He's been on television a lot. He used to run the nationalist bookshop that was in London that had to have barbed wire and metal doors and concrete bollards. Yes, yeah, attacked many times. The communists tried to blow it up many, many times. And he's remained steadfast and kept this bookshop going. And he has a circular. He sends out a circular. Lots of people's names are on it. And he's mainly involved in revisionist history now. He goes out to Germany, to Bad Nenndorf, to protest over there. And we've actually covered some of his stuff before, from when he went over to Bad Nenndorf. We read out the English translation of his speech and talked about that a bit. You probably remember that, Dennis. And as I say, this is another one of his circulars. And this is about Winston Churchill. And he says, prior to the outbreak of the Second World War, Churchill had been an outcast in the political wilderness, excluded from high office, scorned by most Britons as a warmonger and a snob, born with a silver spoon in his mouth and having no discernible interest or concern for the welfare of ordinary folk. From the First World War, Churchill, as a leading figure, was remembered and held responsible for major military defeats at Gallipoli and elsewhere, and then in the 1920s, held responsible as Tory Chancellor of the Exchequer for the Treasury policies that caused the economic slump of that decade. And we're not really told that today, are we? We're not told about his military failures and and the recession that he caused. And he shot the Welsh strikers, didn't he? Shot and killed some of the strikers.
In the greater story, they celebrated when he died in the valleys. But they also don't talk about how he actually became Prime Minister, because they weren't voted. And who was responsible for putting him there? There was no, I ever heard any names.
Well, there was no public support for him. I mean, the guy was a failure, basically, and not very well liked for the way that he had treated people. And also, he was responsible for the concentration camps in the Boer War?
Yep.
Was that him? And something about gassing.
In Ireland as well, he had some shenanigans going on.
Wasn't he gassing people as well? Gassing?
The Kurds, yeah.
Kurds. Yeah, I was thinking, was it him or was it Saddam Hussein?
Churchill
was the first one. both disliked the Kurds.
Saddam got to suffer for it, aren't?
Yeah, and Churchill got promotion. Strange that, isn't it?
Well, another one of his biggest defeats or setbacks was Hong Kong when the Japanese captured it with only a third of the force what the British had defending.
He was supposed to be defending it, was he?
And well, the British were, and he was in charge, and he was given the instructions. I think they had 100,000 troops there and the Japanese had 30,000, but they didn't do a frontal attack. They went through the jungle, which Churchill said they wouldn't do, and they did. And eventually took it.
He's just a total failure. Not the sort of person that you would think, he's the man to lead the country into war. Definitely not.
No.
And the general public were aware of this as well. Richard continues, none of this was forgotten when in 1939, for a second time in a generation, Britain's political establishment declared war on Germany, and after a few months of the so-called phony war, an armed but inactive confrontation between Britain and France on the one side and Germany on the other, Churchill suddenly found himself elevated to Prime Minister of a Britain, the vast majority of whose countrymen did not want a Second World War. The images of the mindless and senseless slaughter of the First War were still fresh in people's minds. Unknown to most to this day, Churchill solved his problem as to how to sell his Second War to the British public by cynically employing the most monstrous deception and lie. Churchill ordered and initiated the bombing of German cities with the calculated intention of goading the Germans into retaliatory bombing of British cities and their defenceless, terrified inhabitants. And Richard Edmund's parents were actually some of the terrified inhabitants that were bombed when Hitler actually fought back, because that was the point of this. That was the point of this, just to get Germany to fight back. And it shows you that not only did Churchill not care about the German civilians, but he didn't care about the British civilians. Because he thought that, well, this is the only way we can get Britain to support us in this war is if Hitler starts bombing Britain. How can we get Hitler to do that? And there's reports of him getting really angry about this and about the fact that Hitler was refusing to actually attack Britain. And
when you say he wasn't, thinking of the English people, he didn't really like the English people. We've gone through this earlier before, where he was one of the, when the EU first came into play, like he was one of the leading guys to push it in. And the EU was brought in, as we know, with Kalergi. And he plays one of Kalergi's speeches. And people go around thinking Churchill was this great hero for Britain, when actually, like I said, at his funeral, when they all turned out, and London was white then, as you can imagine, the people that turned out were the very people he wanted to exterminate.
And he wasn't voted back in again either, was he? After the war, you would think.
How the hell does that all happen when you win a war?
When you win a war and the guy that won the war is voted out. And just when this happened, I mean, this isn't just idle speech here when Richard is saying that the British people didn't want a war. I mean, they ended up locking up the fascists, the British Union of Fascists, Regulation 18B. They locked up all the fascists and apparently in the prison there in the courtyard, there was more brass from the medals than had ever been seen before, because all these people that they locked up were all generals and admirals and people that had been given medals for fighting in the First War. Nobody wanted this Second World War at all. And if you think about the numbers that Oswald Mosley had with his National Union of Fascists, there was a big nationalist movement throughout Europe, and nobody wanted to go to war again. That first war was absolutely horrific. When you think of the people that went there, they were so patriotic and they loved their country so much, and they were hit with gas and they came back maimed and shell-shocked and post-traumatic stress disorder and killing on a scale that had never been known before in history. You think, wars before that had been fought on horseback, and in that one you had tanks and millions of people slaughtered. And they just never seen anything like it. You imagine, you're a peasant, you're a farmer, you love your country, you go out to war, you're used to, using a rifle or a shotgun, maybe, and you go out there.
And the
there,
wind changes direction.
yeah, I absolutely horrific. So there was no support for this war at all. So this was the way that Churchill did it. Continuing here, that it was the British authorities which gave the signal for the start of the bombing war, which mercilessly rained death and destruction, fire and terror onto the homes of millions of defenceless civilians, women, mothers, children and old folk, was confirmed and admitted by the leading British government official and former secretary at the Air Ministry, James Speight, who described in his official book, Bombing Vindicated, quote, "We Britons gave the start signal to the bombing war, which deliberately aimed at targets, the homes of civilians located hundreds of miles behind the front lines," close quote. Speight acknowledged that, quote, "retaliation was certain. if we carried the war into Germany. There was no certainty, but there was a reasonable probability that our capital and our industrial centres would not have been attacked if we had continued to refrain from attacking those of Germany. Close quote. Speight then saw fit to add, "We are proud of our bombing campaign." And that's from Bombing Vindicated by J.M. Speight, CBCBE, published in London, 1944. So they were actually proud of it. After the war, they were proud of the fact that they were the ones that provoked Germany into bombing London and causing the Blitz. And yet you had all these Londoners that when they were attacked, they were, you know, they were really, really anti-Germany after that. And yet, you know, they didn't know that it was a deliberate ploy of Churchill's. And by the time of 1944, they didn't care that it was a deliberate ploy of Churchill's. No,
I mean,
they're saying here they're proud
against,
of it.
It was against international law as well, by the way.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Richard points that out later on. But the fact that shocks me is that, you know, 1944, war's just ended, and yet they were saying that they were proud of actually doing this at that time. He was saying that we are proud of our bombing campaign. And the bombing campaign was absolutely horrific. I was watching a video of Berlin. I think it was yesterday or the day before, and it was a few days after the war, basically, and there's a long shot, and it shows you, like, all the buildings that have been destroyed, and there's a statue of Stalin in one of the streets, and you think of looking at Syria and Iraq, those really bombed-out areas today. Well, this was, you know, 100 times the size of that, like the whole of Berlin, and you think those houses were filled with people in them. There were still people living in these ruins, that, like a whole wall that's been blown away, and there's still people moving around in the room there. Yeah, you've probably seen the video, Dennis. You might have used it. It's a color film, about 8 minutes of what happened. This terror bombing was absolutely awful.
Well, there's no men around then, now, if you remember. All the women were doing all the work of rebuilding.
Yeah, that's all you see in the video.
Is
you just see these women. I mean, I'm not sure how many people were killed in the Blitz, but it just pales into insignificance compared to what was done to Germany. And I think, you know, a similar amount of damage was done to France when they liberated France. Do you know about that, Dennis?
Yeah, I've never heard much about the French being that over impressed with being liberated, apart from the ones who liberated them.
Yeah, because you can imagine there was no damage in France at all. They were just living under an occupation. And when the British went in there to liberate them, you know, you had your D-Day, and then you had war in the country, which they hadn't really had before then.
That's right.
Continuing here, as a direct consequence, within 48 hours of Churchill becoming Britain's Prime Minister in May 1940, the Royal Air Force was ordered to start bombing German cities. The reaction of the Germans and their retaliation came only after months of the persistent bombing of German cities and their civilians. For example, the notorious attack on Coventry by the German Luftwaffe was first undertaken in November 1940. And I guess, obviously, Germany was being bombed for a long time before November 1940. I think it went on for 3 months before...
3 months, yeah.
Yeah, before Hitler actually retaliated. And then we've got a subtitle here. The Luftwaffe was informally invited to bomb London. This astounding admission is a direct quote from the official history of the British Royal Air Force, and describes the situation at the very beginning of Churchill's wartime government in May 1940. And I quote, "If the Royal Air Force raided the Ruhr, the industrial heartland of Germany, destroying oil plants, urban property, the outcry for retaliation against Britain might prove too strong for the German generals to resist. The attack on the Ruhr, in other words, was an informal invitation to the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, to bomb London." And that's from page 122 of the official history of the Royal Air Force, 1939 to 1945, volume 1, author Dennis Richards, from Her Majesty's Stationery Office, 1953. So if that was the deliberate ploy. And it says there, the urban property. So it wasn't just destroying oil plants. It wasn't just destroying manufacturing and industry. It was a deliberate plan to destroy urban property. And urban property is people's homes. And this was done straight away.
They lost a lot of planes as well, didn't they, doing it?
Yeah, yeah, they lost a lot of planes while they were doing this, because obviously, you know, the Germans did have protection there for their civilians. Now, how did Churchill actually get in to be leading the government then, Dennis? Because he wasn't voted in. What was it that happened?
Well, I mean, to most people, he suddenly appeared because, like I said, there was no election. What would have happened is the City of London, they have a council in there anyway, and, you know, if Britain wants to go to war tomorrow, they'll go into the City of London and ask for the funds, and if the funds aren't supplied, Britain will go to war. So there's a council in there, and they decide, and they must have decided that the right man for the job was Churchill. Suddenly he was given the job as Prime Minister, and nobody's ever really gone into any depth on it.
And what happened to Chamberlain then? I mean, Chamberlain had come back with peace in our time, and he's holding his piece of paper, and he's negotiated a peace.
Well, I think the press jumped on him.
Yeah, because they hated that.
Yeah, well, Hitler was annoyed at that because he felt that Chamberlain had done quite a good job at Munich, and he was more than happy, and so was Britain. And he went back there and waving his piece of paper, saying they weren't going to win it. But all he got was appeasement from the press, and obviously the other quarters as well of society. And eventually, you know, it was pushed into going.
You know, it really is like it's the intelligence services that are running everything. I mean, it's the intelligence services that have got their spies in the media and the journalists. A huge portion of the mainstream media journalists are also working for the intelligence agencies. And they're the ones that put the pressure on these politicians to do what they want them to do. And the intelligence services, I mean, they're part of the deep state, aren't they, that controls everything. And a lot of their power comes through their control of the press. And this was going on even back then, you know, all this appeasement stuff.
I can remember when, what she called, May, Prime Minister, she was supposed to go into an election with another woman, apparently, before she got the job, but the other woman was told to step down. And that's probably come from the same quarter, because they probably felt, you know, they wanted May as Prime Minister. And this other person, without much of an excuse, just stepped aside.
Andrea Leadsom. I think when they put Andrea Leadsom in, I think she was deliberately put in there because there was no chance she could win. She was hardly been heard of. And the press tried to big her up to be, you know, a worthy opponent of Theresa May. And she was nothing, really. And she said something about Theresa May not having children. And, you know, since she's not a mother, she doesn't understand what it's like to be a mother. And then she was lambasted for that. And she stepped down and Theresa May was crowned. It was obvious that the press wanted Theresa May in. And it's obvious today that they really don't want Boris Johnson in. And the BBC are just constantly attacking Boris Johnson over things. It's blatant, the fact that they don't want him to be Prime Minister, which is why I want him to be Prime Minister. And you just look at Donald Trump's summit with the social media summit the other day, and look at the way the mainstream media were behaving there, physically attacking, trying to pick fights with the social media people. Just terrible behavior, making all this noise at the end of the summit so you couldn't hear what the questions were, and then cutting the live feed. I mean, behaving like spoilt, petulant children. They've been told they can't have their own way. Yeah, well, they are. They're activists, aren't they? You know, the mainstream journalists, they're activists. I think there was I don't know if there ever was a time that the media was really there for the people. I mean, it's become...
No, I think that's a fair point that I can't say for sure myself. I think they've always been used as a tool.
And you think
especially with democracy, because they can influence an election. As I mean, going back to the days of the Sun, early days of the Sun and the Daily Mirror, you know, this constant whoever they wanted, you know, they managed to get in because obviously the person like Sir Michael Foot was totally slaughtered.
Well, Robert Maxwell, didn't he? He said, you know, it's the Sun what got Blair in, or John Major, yeah, or whatever. He used to boast that it was the Sun what won it.
It's Murdoch, isn't it?
Murdoch, yeah.
Boys, as was Cameron. So that's no surprise. Now, he's used the Sun, you know, to sway public opinion his way.
I think back to the printing press, when they got the printing press, and then they started printing the Bibles, and who was it that was funding a lot of that? It was Jews that were funding that. And they were funding the printing of these Bibles with spurious translations. So they were involved in publishing back then. They've always been involved in publishing. And I think Henry Ford talked about them buying up all the newspapers in America. They probably did the same in Europe. And it talks in the protocols, doesn't it, about how they control all the printing presses.
Yeah, because if you can control the media and the press, then you only allow out what you want people to hear, which is maybe sometimes even worse than lying.
And this is what we see today. This is when we see them, you know, just writing absolute nonsense about things that nationalists say. You know, the total opposite of what nationalists say. They will print in their newspapers, and another newspaper will pick it up and quote it, and another one will quote it, and then it has weight because it's been quoted by all these different newspapers. But in actual fact, it would have been, you know, it would be a blatant lie right from the very beginning. And you look at the crushing of Tommy Robinson for contempt of court.
I've missed out on that, actually. I heard somewhere that there's some riots, but I haven't. So I've been watching the mainstream media, so I'm not that I think it shows it on there anyway, but I don't know a lot about that. Has he been crushed?
2 months in prison, yeah. He's been sent to prison for 2 months for a contempt of court charge, and all the other contempt of court charges that have involved trials falling apart. The Daily Mirror and I think the Daily Mail or the Express, the most they were fined were £10,000. And they said that, well, in this case, it was because it was an individual, they were going to jail him. I don't understand that. Why, if it's the mainstream media that really should know better, and they get caught, you know, causing a whole trial to fall apart, they just get a small fine. But a citizen journalist who is doing this out of the goodness of his heart, he gets sent to prison for it?
Well, as you know, I mean, I'm not a big fan of him, but I obviously see what he's doing, a certain amount of attention drawing, which obviously the establishment are not impressed with. And to get these prison sentences, I mean, last time he had a horrible time in prison, I believe, and I don't think it'll be any different this time, I would imagine, because there were people out there to actually kill him, weren't there, these Muslims?
Oh, what it shows you is that the mainstream media is you know, it's a part of the government. It's almost more powerful than the government in some instances. And the government is happy with that. They don't want citizen journalists. They don't want an alternative media. You know, you think if the government were honest, they would want an alternative media. Donald Trump wants an alternative media. He's doing everything he can to help the alternative media. Because he's on the side of the truth, I think. I mean, much as, you know, you can criticize Donald Trump, I mean, that is, you know, that's a big difference between him and all the other politicians in the world or in the Western world, is that he is supporting the alternative media and saying the mainstream media, it's fake news and it's full of lies. And it's the alternative media that is telling the truth.
Because they're left wing and they're always attacking him. And I think he's of, you know, I think there's two sets of Jews at war here. One's the left wing and one's the right wing. And people like Putin and Trump are for the right wing. And hence that is why the mainstream media is forever attacking Trump and Putin.
But he still supports the alternative media. And, there's right and there's left. There's right and there's left on that. It's free speech that needs supporting here. And getting back to this email here from Richard. 50,000 British civilians were victims of the enemy air attacks on London and other major cities and towns. What these poor victims never knew, and what the great majority of Britons to this day do not know, is that Churchill's wartime government wanted the bombing war and had started the bombing war deliberately in order to induce a war psychosis, a type of madness in the British people. As the British military expert and historian General J.F.C. Fuller explained, quote, "In England, political power had passed into the hands of demagogues who, by playing on the emotions and ignorance of the masses, created a permanent war psychosis." Close quote. And that's from pages 404 to 405, The Second World War, by Major General J.F.C. Fuller, CB, CBE, DSO, published in London, Eyre and Spottiswood, 1948. So 50,000 British civilians were the victims of Germany's retaliation.
Now, sacrifice, if you like.
Yeah, you think how many hundreds of thousands were victims of Britain in Germany? And yet a lot more than that. I mean, how many was it just in Dresden? Yeah.
Well, it goes up to 200,000, you know, which some people's estimation.
200,000.
They're talking 20,000.
Four times as many in one night.
Yes.
In one night. You got 50,000 is the total in well, it says London and our other major cities in town. So that's the whole of Britain. 50,000 is all that the Germans killed. Not whole cities like Britain did to Germany. And this was the retaliation. And there you've got it openly there. It was in order to induce a war psychosis in the British people. And I think
they really also attacked as soon as he invaded the Soviet Union as well. They set him up in the bombing of the cities as well. So you got the soldiers on the front there fighting, not knowing whether the families were safe back home again, which is another psychological warfare.
And they wound, again, the press wound all the public up about how uniquely evil the Germans were, and the Germans were bombing them. So, you know, at the end of the war, the British troops mistreated the Germans, and there was the torture of them in order to get these confessions, as we've spoken about before. Yeah. This war psychosis must have played into that. Even when the Germans were saying, look, you know, this didn't happen, the British weren't interested. And you remember Himmler was saying to his daughter, look, surrender to the British. They will treat you well. And yet the British all had this war psychosis from the media and exaggerating these bombing campaigns. Go on.
Well, we're just going to say today, I mean, they were fools. You know, the English, should I say, people who was involved in the war, in the Second World War, I'm pretty sure if they knew what, you know, Britain was going to be about today and the EU, I'm pretty sure that they wouldn't have been as tucked in as they were. But obviously they have no idea that their own countries would now face, you know, this race mixing, and all white countries now are under fire, even those in World War II.
Oh, they were told they were fighting for freedom, fighting for the right to free speech, to speak your mind. That was part of it, fighting for freedom. Yep. Well, you know, what are they doing with freedom of speech today? They were told, you know, if we don't fight Germany, then they'll have everybody speaking German in London. And they're speaking Punjabi, Afghani, Somali, Swahili.
Yeah.
Fighting for Christianity. And look at the Christian churches that are all being turned into mosques. You know, we were told that, Hitler was going to do away with it.
Churchill said that about fighting about Christianity in his fighting on the beaches speech. And I mean, he's saying that at the same time that the American government and the British government are keeping afloat the biggest Christian killer of all time, Stalin.
That propaganda bit, there's an English propaganda, and it's got a Bible and a swastika and a knife going through the Bible. And it's written in English, yeah. You have to be pretty daft to fall for that one. But that's what they were trying to promote. And again, as we talked about it in a few podcasts back, about this allegation that Rosenberg was going to get rid of the church and put the Mein Kampf book on every altar, and he was going to rewrite the Bible, and they were going to be praying to Hitler. And this was all nonsense. It was all, we don't even know if that was just a fantasy that somebody wrote down, but it was certainly never anything that was supposed to be implemented. And the Reich Church was basically going to be the same sort of thing as the Anglican Church. It was going to be the Church of Germany. And it wasn't going to have changes to make them all worship Hitler or any nonsense like that. But that's what people were told in the press. That was reported in the press as being what
they believed
was going to do.
Well, they believed the government's in them there, didn't they?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when was it that people stopped believing them? Was it after Nixon? Was it after Iraq? I mean, I can remember reading in the press, like, oh, after this weapons of mass destruction thing, people lost faith in the government. But we're still hearing the same today, aren't we? After this failure in Brexit, the people have lost faith in the government. I think, you know,
they're
saying it all the time.
I think Cameron lost the vote, didn't he?
Yeah.
I think he was upset with Obama. But Syria, they finally saw the light and said, no way.
Yeah, that was a stroke of luck, that, wasn't it? Really?
Just.
That they voted against that. Continuing. During the Second World War, hundreds of thousands in total fell victim to the British and American bombing of civilians. It is, of course, a war crime for a soldier to aim his weapon at a civilian. But such war crimes the British and American governments permitted themselves a million times over, a cold-blooded barbarism of which the British Secretary at the Air Ministry said that he was proud. It can be said that Britain's honour was retrieved somewhat by the British academic Charles Percy Snow, a leading figure at the time, who publicly expressed his shame. Quote, "The British plans to destroy the working-class districts of German cities reveal a deeply rooted, sadistic impulse to kill thousands of women and children," close quote. And Snow went further. "What will future generations think of us Britons? Will they say that we were wolves in the shape of men? Will future generations think that we Britons forswore our humanity? They will have the right to say so." The British academic C.P. Snow published that in Science and Government in 1961. So yeah, it is a war crime for a soldier to aim his weapon at a civilian. So how much more of a war crime is it to aim bombs at them and missiles at them?
Don't get any worse, does it really?
Yeah, I mean, just blowing hundreds of them up at a time. Maybe that's what they said. Yeah, maybe they said, well, it's not against the law. You know, it's not against the law to aim a gun at a civilian. There's nothing that says we can't, you know, aim at hundreds of them all at the same time. Maybe that was
the thing.
The
thing is, like, they actually made bombs specifically for it. You know, they had these bombs what caused the firestorms, which, you know, then caused any survivors to meet this draft of fire. So purposely taking out the rest of the civilians.
Imagine the heat of it just melted everything into the asphalt.
Yeah.
And the heat the next day, and then the emergency services going there a few days later to try and get the bodies, and the bodies are just melted or burnt into a cinder. People were evaporated with the heat. They just evaporated in some instances with these firestorms. Just absolutely horrific.
After the firestorm, and people finally came out from, you know, the actual backdraft, they had Spitfires chasing them up and down.
Yeah, they went after the emergency services. Yeah. They went after the emergency services. And, of course, they've played down the numbers of victims at the time. There were estimates given. And today they are constantly bringing the number of these victims down. So they say, you know, what was it, 20,000 died at Dresden or 2,000, ridiculous number. That because that was a centre for refugees. It was a cultural centre anyway, with a circus there and all the artists there. And then you had all these injured people, refugees, women, children, and they all went there because they thought, well, there's no way that they'll bomb this place because it's not a military target. There's nothing that can be gained from this. It would just be an act of sadistic barbarity to bomb this place, like bombing a nursery school or something. And yet they did.
And yeah, I think they were coming in from the east as well with the communists pushing. think we're coming in by the thousands from refugees, you know, trying to escape them.
Escaping from them. And then you've got these protests that are there today where nationalists go there to remember the dead. And then you've got anti-fascists there with signs saying, go on, Bomber Harris, do it again. That's how brainwashed the German people have been since this war with this denazification process. They call for it to happen again. They just have no idea of their history. Can't have asking for that to happen again. And we've got a postscript here, something to think about. Churchill's wartime government was formed of a coalition of all three establishment parties, Tory, Labour, and Liberal. All the more reason to hate these organised conspiracies against the British people. So I guess what he's saying there is, you know, this wasn't just Churchill, remember, that was all three of the establishment parties in a coalition government at the time.
Yeah, well, if truth be known, in democracies, they're all the same anyway, because that's how it works. When Tory gets in, they may have some different policies, but the main policies don't change when the Labour government get in, you know, and that's the secret of the dictatorship behind the curtain. People think there's going to be change, but there never has been.
Well, we see this in Europe, when you see a party like the Front National or the National Rally in France, and they're doing really well, and they look like they're going to win. So what happens? The left and the right work together to defeat them, instead of sticking to their principles or their ideals. So that shows you that their ideals are just on paper. They don't actually hold to them. It's all a scam to pretend that there's any difference between them. We've got some extra quotes here, the ones that you dug out to go along with this, Dennis. This one's from September 1924. Mr. Winston Churchill published an article in Pall Mall magazine that recognised with cynical openness that air terror against women and children was the most effective method of military leadership. And Mr. Churchill wrote, "One should invent a bomb no larger than an orange that could blow up an entire city, churches, apartments, and all. I am in favour," he continued, "of spreading certain types of bacteria among men and animals, spreading blight to destroy crops, anthrax to infect horses and livestock, and the plague to kill not only whole armies, but the inhabitants of whole regions. I call all this advanced military science."
Can I just stop you there a second?
Yes.
Why would a Christian say churches?
Why would you want to blow up a church?
Especially if you were a Christian.
Yeah.
Or a so-called Christian.
Well, why would you want to kill whole populations? I mean, why would you want to wipe out not just whole armies, but the inhabitants of entire regions?
Exactly.
And, somebody that was, you know, looking for the atomic bomb and no doubt would have used it if he'd had a chance to, in favour of chemical and biological weapons. And you can think about Adolf Hitler that refused any usage of gas at all in World War II.
I think they were lucky, Germany, as well, that the bomb, I mean, some say the bomb was a myth, but if the bomb did exist, then Germany were lucky that the war ended when it did, because I've heard certain politicians in America at that time saying they wish they could have dropped it on Germany.
Yeah, I can remember reading a book by Jerry Paxman, and it was about chemical or biological weapons. Yeah. And in it, it had a bit about saying that, you know, Hitler refused the use of gas during the Second World War because of his experience of being gassed in the First World War. And this was before I'd looked into revisionism or anything like that. I thought, well, that's a bit bizarre, isn't it? Because we're told he gassed all the Jews. And yet he refused to use gas in the war.
On the Bolsheviks, when the Bolsheviks were coming.
Yeah, and I was thinking, well, hang on a minute. So he didn't use it against the enemies he was fighting against. He just used it against people that he had in prisons? That doesn't make any sense. You know, it doesn't make any sense, but those quotes are there. You know, those quotes are there. And that again, that shows you that Hitler, because he fought in the war, he had compassion and didn't want a war. Churchill had obviously just been leading and never actually been on the front line, never experienced gas or chemical warfare or anything like that.
Privileged.
So he was in favour of it. I have another quote here. Despite constant disregard for his disarmament proposals, Adolf Hitler acted according to the demands of humanity at the moment of his decisions. As our army began its revenge against the blinded Polish pseudo-state on the 1st of September 1939, the German Luftwaffe received particularly strict instructions with regards to its choice of targets. As the Führer said in his speech to the Reichstag on 1st of September 1939, "I do not want to wage war against women and children. I have given my Luftwaffe the order to limit their attacks to military targets." The world knows that the Führer held to his principle. On the 19th of September 1939, speaking in the Artist Court in the liberated city of Danzig, he repeated the statement, "I have given the German Luftwaffe the order to fight this war humanely, which means that they will attack only fighting troops." Compare that to Churchill. Let's go out there and bomb the civilians.
Yeah, a lot of people claim Hitler actually bombed at Warsaw with civilians in, but he gave them war. He offered them a chance for civilians to leave, and he was didn't even get a reply.
So he did give them a warning. He said, "Look, if you don't get out of there in a certain number of days, we're going to attack."
Yeah, in fact, he even extended the time he was going to attack, just in case, you know, the reply was somehow late for some other reason.
And when in the war did that happen then?
When they took Poland, when 1939, when they first went into Poland.
So this was a part of this. So when they needed to take Warsaw, look, hand down your weapons, get your children out of there, get your women out of there, because we don't want to attack them.
Yeah.
Big difference. The Führer characterized the characteristic British attitude in the same speech in Danzig. He said, "England has already begun the war against women and children with lies and hypocrisy. It has a weapon it believes unassailable, namely sea power. And it says, since we ourselves cannot be attacked with this weapon, we are justified in using it, if necessary, to fight not only the women and children of our enemy, but also those of neutral nations. One should not deceive oneself. The time could soon come when we too use a weapon that cannot be used against us. One hopes others then do not suddenly remember the principles of humanity and the impossibility of waging war against women and children. We Germans do not do that. It is not our way." And again, that bombing of the women and children, the British thought that would weaken the country's resolve and it would weaken their support for Hitler, and it did the absolute opposite.
That's right.
It strengthened their support, and they fought to the last woman and child, really. When they knew they were losing the war, that there was still, you know, 100% support for Hitler, because
never turned on Hitler once.
No, but because of what had been done to them, because it was so despicable to be going after the weakest members of society like that.
That's right.
Got one final quote here, and this was after the 3 months of Britain bombing Germany, and this is Adolf Hitler in his speech about retaliating against Britain. He says, "You know that I have proposed to the world for years the cessation of bombing warfare, especially against civilian populations. Probably aware of what would come, England refused. Democracies are always clairvoyant. Well and good. Despite that, I have never waged war against civilians in this war. I allowed no night attacks on Polish cities. One cannot target precisely at night. I generally allowed attacks only during the day and always against military targets. I did the same in Norway. I did the same in Holland, Belgium, and France. Then it suddenly occurred to Mr. Churchill to attack the German civilian population at night. You know how patient I am. I watched for 8 days. They dropped bombs on the people of the Rhine. They dropped bombs on the people of Westphalia. I watched for another 14 days. I thought that the man was crazy. He was waging a war that could only destroy England. I waited over 3 months, but then one day I gave the order, I will take up the battle. So a lot of patience there, waiting three months.
Well, it's never the same taking up the battle when your heart's not in it, and I don't believe Hitler's heart was in it, whereas Churchill's were. I don't think Hitler got any satisfaction from retaliating in that way, but was left with no option.
He had no desire to fight against England, did he? I mean, he wanted to have an alliance with England. He looked up to England, looked up to Britain, and you can see the general feeling towards the English people from Himmler. I mean, obviously they knew that the people that were leading the government were responsible for all this terror bombing, but they never actually blamed the British people for that, because they knew that they'd been lied to by their governments, they'd been lied to by the mainstream media, well, the only media, and they knew that the British people were their racial brothers. So they knew that they had the same spirit and the same soul as themselves, and they knew that they wouldn't be doing that unless they'd been misled. And they knew they'd been misled. Because they knew they'd been misled up until, you know, the advent of National Socialism. They knew they saw what had happened in their country with Weimar and all the degeneracy, and they saw what was happening in the East with Bolshevism, and they realized it had to be stopped. And Britain was cut off from that. You know, Britain wasn't connected to any of these countries that saw what the Bolsheviks were doing.
That was the problem with Britain. It was away from Europe, or mainland Europe. British people didn't really have any knowledge of what was going on there, apart from what, you know, the Rothschilds agencies allowed, which they did in the same with the Boer War when they put the women in prison. When the British people found out about that, they were horrified.
And I guess that's, you know, one of the reasons why they didn't want them to find out about what had happened during the Second World War, because they knew after that Boer War, there was a backlash. There was a backlash against it. And this was the first war where they've never admitted at the end of it that a lot of the propaganda was lies. They seized on it and thought, well, we'll use this as our excuse for everything that we did.
Well, many years after World War One, that people actually got to hear about people being starved, you know, with that blockade after the war. You know, that was all kept out of the media. It's the old thing that we just said earlier on, that if you control the media, you control what people get to hear. And that can be worse than lying.
Well, it's the same thing today, isn't it? I mean, the mainstream media will rubbish people like Tommy Robinson and PJ Watson or whatever, and they're not on Facebook, they're not on Twitter, they can't respond to it. It's like they've had their voice taken away from them. I mean, you know, obviously it's different. You've got people that are, you know, that are being starved, and there's a blockade on them, and the rest of the world isn't being told about it. But, you know, they got the same thing today, is silencing people and taking away their voice so that the rest of the world doesn't know what's going on. There's a long history of this.
That's right. It highlights the fact that
our governments are occupied, doesn't it, really? It just highlights the fact that the people that govern us aren't of the same people as us. They don't have our best interests at heart. This whole idea of democracy is a scam.
People don't realise that now, they never will do.
Well, I think more and more people are realising it. That's what populism is, isn't it? Populism is based around trying to get rid of the false elites and saying that the people that are running the government, they're not the elites that we want. They're false elites. They're elites that are there through being greedy and through usury and through deceitful behaviour and lying to people. And we want elites that are there because, you know, they're the very best people. They're the very best people that our race has to offer. We want them to be running things. People with a loyalty to their nation and a loyalty to their country, not a loyalty to the economy or a loyalty to making as much money as possible. We want people that have a loyalty to their people and want their people to succeed and prosper. And that should be the genuine elite. If it wasn't for usury, then you could have wealth as a means of gauging who would be worthy to be an elite. Because if you didn't have usury and you had somebody that was really wealthy, the only way they could have got that wealth was through being innovative, very hard working, and being good to people and being a good businessman and being very intelligent. Yeah, that's the only way they could rise to the top. But once you add usury to it, and people can just make money with money, or they can just make money out of thin air, then you end up with the worst sort of people that rise to the top.
Which is what we have today.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. Usury is so important. I mean, I know we often, you know, we talk about race and everybody says how important race is, and you can talk about subversion, particularly subversive actions that come from certain groups among the Jews, but not enough people really talk about usury and make a big point of just, you know, how the knock-on effect from usury has affected everything, the whole system.
I don't think people actually understand it, Sven. I think, you know, most people think that banks need to charge like this because otherwise they'll go out of business. They don't seem to understand that, you know, in countries, especially Muslim countries, they don't charge it. They put a charge on, but it doesn't multiply and multiply and multiply so that the person who is really, you know, the worst possible victim, the one with no money, he's getting penalised more than anybody.
The way it used to be before, you could invest money to hopefully make money, but if whatever you were investing in failed, it wasn't that the person that borrowed it then still had to pay it all back. You know, both of you lost it. You couldn't go in there and take his property just because the business venture failed. And instead of having interest on top, it was a percentage of the profits that you would have on top if you lent out money. So if you did lend out money and something happened and you didn't make the profits, you lost out and the person lost out. He didn't have to pay all that money back and all the interest on top. You know, that's an important side of it. Because, you know, you can have the greatest intentions and a business venture can go wrong. And that's what money should be used for, to encourage more business, not to be used as collateral to get more loans and bundled up in forms of debt so that you can create even more debt.
I think there was a part in Coming by the Back Door where E. Michael Jones did a great piece on usury. You know, the ordinary person can understand that it's gone through our history that it gets to a point where the moneylenders eventually do face the wrath of the people. But not always they do get away with it.
Well, it's one of those things that the populists could highlight, you know, which would be useful. Obviously, they can't speak too much about race. They can't speak too much about the Jews. I mean, in some cases, they can't speak too much about Muslims. But they could speak about usury. They could speak about usury without falling foul of any hate speech laws, Islamophobia laws. and it's so central to it all. Yeah, but I mean, they could do it without the legal problems. Maybe that's something these populists should look at doing. Because nobody likes being in debt. And everybody knows that, you know, these huge interest rates that they put on payday loans and credit cards and everything else is hammering people. I think most of the country, are in debt.
Usually, people don't realise it. I mean, they don't realise that the credit card, what they've been offered, is another form of usury. Because they know at some point, when times aren't good, you're going to use that card, and then the interest goes on top of it, and it's worse than a bank loan. But, you know, people don't seem to realise that is being used against them because they think it's an easy way out to get some money.
And if it wasn't for the credit cards, I mean, that's where the money is created. It's people saying, well, I need to borrow this money. And we think of it as being borrowed, but in actual fact, you're creating it because you need that money. That money is created, that goes into circulation, and then you have to pay it back. You have to work to pay it back. So you're actually creating for the economy and then being penalized for it by having this interest that's put on top so that can go to these private individuals rather than even going into the collective wealth of the nation. It's so important the way this works. And that's why they don't like people to look into it and to understand it. And people think, no, it's all boring. I mean, I'm terrible with numbers.
Never teach it at school, do they?
No, but you've got to learn this stuff. You've got to learn this stuff. And that, you know, that was one of the really good points about the National Socialists was they did fight against usury. Anyway, come to the end of the podcast now, Dennis. Thank you very much for coming on today.
Oh.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We'll be back next Friday with more Truthful Out Radio for you. And of course, we do hope you all have a great summer weekend ahead of you.
To Radio Aryan.